of his body.
Most people, Friday is just a day before the weekend. But after this Friday, neighborhood will never be the same.
Football Fridays are on the Fan.
2012 AFC West champs.
It's a Bud Light Football Friday on the Fan.
Talking about finishing, right? That's the way to finish.
Football is a rough game and often a cruel one.
Every time you lose, you die a little bit. You die inside a portion of you.
Time to get you pumped for the pigskin. Bud Light, the official beer sponsor of the NFL. Here we go. And as we gear up for our football weekend on Sports Radio 104.3, the Fan.
You know I'm getting the ball. They know I'm getting the ball tonight, too.
We can't wait.
Oh, I'll get the ball. Oh, I'm going to get the ball tonight.
We live and breathe it all day long right here with you on the Fan.
Let y'all charge.
Getting ready for football and to crack a few Bud Lights this weekend.
Hey, we're calling the plays, all right?
Shut up, so please, one, two,
Denver's football station.
Ain't too much talking to be going on tonight. All about hitting.
Now, here's Sandy Clough.
Ah, yes, this is everything a Football Friday should be on this 15th day of November 2013. Sandy Clough with you. A Bud Light Football Friday, yes, on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Earlier, Adam Meyer, RealMoneySports.com, likes Denver, but is a little bit uncomfortable about this game on Sunday night from the Bronco point of view. Likes Denver to win, but thinks it will be tight. Terrell Davis with more or less the same outlook, joining us, of course, from NBC Sports. As always on Football Friday mornings, Chad Brown during the 10 o'clock hour, commenting at length on what is likely to happen on Sunday night. Likes Denver, but it's a cautious nod in favor of the Broncos. And now the good doctor returns for his appearance. Always a big game guy. He's back in studio with us today for the entire hour. 303-228-1043 on the phones. 29588. The Total Beverage text line. Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State University of Colorado. And you're fired up. We were talking during the break. You're ready to go. Love talking about a game like this because this is rich in psychological ramifications and possibilities, isn't it?
Absolutely.
This game.
Yeah, Sandy, it's a great, great time of the year because now teams are starting to make their move towards the playoffs. And obviously, you know, not only with the physiological abilities, teams asserting themselves, but also the mental piece.
Yep.
Here's a time in the season when people are looking at injuries being a factor, at belief systems, how they feel about themselves going forward. So it's a great time of the year. Just got back from Alabama last weekend, so I'm fired up and ready to go.
Yeah, and you've been around the Alabama program, not only the football program, but we'll get into that in a little while, about the Alabama psychology and why Alabama has become on so many athletic fronts kind of a model institution. We'll get into your thoughts on Saban, whom you know so well, later on in this hour. And talk about this game, number one offense versus number one defense. Okay, now, if I recall correctly, in your football coaching background, you're a defensive guy.
Yes, absolutely.
You hear all the time that, well, it's a passing league. It's an offense-driven sport now. That when number one offense meets number one defense will cave and submit to the formidable nature of the number one offense and all the rules changes that come about to benefit offense?
Yeah.
You know, do you buy that, Tony?
No, I do not. Let me tell you why. I hear people say, yeah, the NFL, and largely to the degree of college and high school as well, is a passing game now. You know, I want to dispel the notion, Sandy, that it's a passing game. It's a passing game as long as you make it a passing game. And what I mean by that is this. If a team can go out there and line up in double tights, power formation, run ISO, run power, run any kind of waggle formation where you're just, you know, blocking, trying to get 3 or 4 yards of crack, and you can control the ball and, much more important, control the clock and keep the other team's offense off the field, you can win football games. And again, I know most teams have gone to a lot of these spread offenses and they're throwing the ball around the yard and they're winning that way. But when I look in the newspaper on Sunday morning and I see college football games 48-45 or I wake up Monday morning and I see scores like 42-38 in the NFL, you know, it just really, it really dispels the notion that we're putting much emphasis on defense. I still believe wholeheartedly that you can line up in power formations, run ISO at people, and if you can control the clock. I mean, here we go. Quantitatively speaking, if you get 3.3 yards a crack on offense by running the ball, you can control the ball all game long. Now, we both know that not many teams in the NFL are that patient to do it. But I'll tell you what, teams can be successful by running the ball, and the NFL is an example of
But you're talking about the psychology of running the ball.
Yeah.
More than the actual physical effect. You're speaking of the psychology of running the ball and staying patient with a running game.
Yes, that's the key. The whole key of being patient in a running game is the mental piece. Oftentimes, coaches will abandon the running game because they're not getting 4 or 5 or 7 yards a crack. And so psychologically, they say to themselves, they look at their game plan, and they say, we're not moving the ball down the field. Well, guess what? If you control the ball, you're keeping the other offense off the field. And I think too many coaches in the NFL, college, and high school are not patient enough psychologically to trust their game plan and trust their players to execute on the field to control the ball. Because I'll tell you what, a perfect example of a local team is Columbine High School. Columbine has won state championships for many years without very good athletes. I mean, I apologize, but you don't have the best athletes. But he controls the game. When you play Columbine, we played him in year 2000 in the semifinals.
When you were with Mullen.
When I was coaching at Mullen.
Yeah.
And we knew we were going to get the ball at the most 5 times. And that's what we got it. Okay, we got it 5 times. And they ended up beating us, I think it was 23-21. But my point is, if Kansas City decides...
We scored 60% of the time.
We did.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, but if Kansas City decides on Sunday to line up in a power formation, run ISO, run power, run waggle at Denver, and they can get enough yards to keep the chains moving, then I would look for him to really try and do that because, again, you're keeping Peyton Manning off the field.
303-228-1043, 295-88, Total Beverage text line. Let's go to the phones. Ed, you're on the fan with Sandy Clef and, of course, Dr. Rick Perea. Good morning.
Good morning, Sandy. Enjoy your show always.
Thank you.
I don't know. There's no way we'd probably get a message to Eric Decker. He could probably care less what I think, maybe a little bit more what you think. But, you know, we love Eric Decker. We think he's a great receiver. I just think he has fallen into a mentality that he looks for flags more than he looks for the ball, and I think it's affecting his play.
We will let Dr. Perea address that. Of course, we talk about the Bronco receivers with 9 touchdown catches this year, and Decker had, I think, 13 a year ago, but he's not one of the 3 with 9. That's Demaryius and Julius Thomas, and that's, of course, Wes Welker. Decker with 3. I think Decker's had a pretty good year. Manning seemed to trust him, but the caller, to the psychological point of Decker lobbying for calls, even during the course of running a pass route, waving his arms and all that.
Right.
We've been arguing that point a little bit, particularly on the Fan Morning Show this week. Should the Broncos be campaigning for calls, or should they stay out of the officiating business entirely, or at least the advice to officials business?
Yeah, they need to stay out of it because I have friends that are officials, and they'll tell you that when players and coaches are crying about calls, psychologically they'll go the other way. And so what players need to do, whether it's Decker or whoever it is, they need to play the game hard, play the game the way they were taught, use the fundamentals and techniques they were taught, and let the officials call the game. We all know that there's penalties on every play. There's holding in the offensive line. There's holding on for corners, hold receivers all the time. And some of them are taught to do that. Just run your patterns, use your technique, do what you're supposed to do, and let the officiating stay with them. And teams psychologically will be better off because when you're focused on those relevant cues, which is your assignment and not the irrelevant cues like officiating, you'll have a much better chance to reach your goals.
I think we know Kansas City is going to be real physical the way Indy was with Denver's receivers. So the response you're saying can't be one of, hey, I'm being fouled, hey, you got to call something. They got to fight through it. They did it more toward the end of the Indianapolis game, but for the better part of 3 quarters in that game, they really weren't doing it. They were spending more time complaining than fighting through the coverage. 303-228-1043, 295-88, Total Beverage text line. 11-13, Sandy Clef, Dr. Rick Perea on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. /11:19 on a Bud Light Football Friday. Sandy Clef with you on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest. We're talking about the Broncos and Chiefs on Sunday. We'll get to some other football-related issues as well with a good doctor between now and noontime. We'll get to some of your texts on the Total Beverage text line at 29588. I don't know that you like the Chiefs necessarily to win on Sunday night, but you seem to be making the point that Kansas City is in a pretty favorable position going into this game from a psychological point of view, and part of that is the fact that there's a rematch. Win or lose Sunday night, the Chiefs get a rematch in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I think
in Kansas City.
You bet. And I think for that reason, Kansas City has the psychological driver's seat or the psychological edge going into this game. Because, you know, in 3 weeks, 3 week period of time, these two teams are going to kind of separate themselves from each other.
Sure.
And so based on this game, I think the Broncos need to win this game more than the Chiefs do. Because let's say, theoretically speaking, the Broncos win, and then regardless of what happens with New England, when they play again in Kansas City, Kansas City is in the bird's eye seat to determine, okay, what do we want to determine? What do we want to show on offense? What do we want to show and deploy on defense? If it's a real must-win game, or if it's a situation where they can, you know, still play their cards right and still win the division. I mean, the ultimate goal is to win the division and have home field advantage. That's what they're, really trying to get. And so when I look at this game, I think Denver needs to win it more than Kansas City. And psychologically speaking, that can be the difference in the edge coming in.
All right. Back to the psychology of the running game with Kyle on the phone, John. Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan with Sandy Clef and Dr. Rick Perea. Hello, Kyle.
Hey, Sandy. Hey, Dr. P.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, not too much, man. I was just calling in to talk a little bit about, I know you guys were talking about the running game and sticking with it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can average 3-4 yards a carry. What I want to talk about is I think the Broncos can do that because the Chiefs are actually last in the NFL in yards per carry defense. And I just want to hear what you think about that in regards to the Broncos being the ones that will stick with the run game instead of the Chiefs.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know the Broncos' idea is that they don't want No'Shawn carrying the ball more than 15 times a game. But there's Monte Ball who got some work last week. Maybe he can get 10 to 12 carries. Maybe it's 12 to 15 for No'Shawn. But your point is basically, even if it's not working great early on, stick with it. If the Broncos get ahead 10 points, 14 points, stick with the run. Last week, you know, they were up 28-6, pretty comfortable lead. San Diego comes back, makes it 28-13 off the Manning fumble. But the Broncos, by the end of the day, out of 60 plays, only ran it 22 times.
Right.
You're not crazy about that ratio, especially when you have the lead through major portions of the game, are you?
No, I'm not, because I think one of the things that we look at in sports psychology is the psychological breakdown of teams, and really that's what happens in the NFL. You know, Sandy, all these players are great athletes, very physiologically capable. What happens to defenses, you know, people say they get wore down. Well, they get wore down psychologically first before they get wore down physiologically. And the thing to remember about that is a belief system. We call that self-efficacy. And when a team runs the ball against you, gets 3, 4, 5 yards a crack, and keeps the defense out there for a number of plays, that really wears you down psychologically first. I remember playing college football on defense, and it is a demoralizing feeling to line up and know that you cannot stop this offense. They're getting 4, 5, 7 yards a crack running the ball, and they're just sticking with it. They're running power. They're running ISO. They're running waggle at you where you just are unable to stop. So in regards to Kyle's question, I would say that, you know what, in terms of the quantitative assessment, it would appear that Denver could line up and run the ball against Kansas City. But again, the qualitative side of that, Kyle, is that it's the human experience aspect. What are the matchups? You know, what are the matchups with Dontari Poe playing the one technique and the 3 and the 5 and the 7 technique and how they match up against Denver? How Kansas City has matched up against the other teams they've played is really an independent variable. In psychology, when we do research, we separate variables. And what Kansas City has done against other teams is independent of what they're going to do against Denver, because you have different players, different gap responsibilities, different assignments. So we can't really compare that quantitative aspect. That's why we play the game.
Get back to the receivers a little bit. We were talking during the break, and the caller asked about Decker earlier. The Broncos seem to come out of the bye week with two major objectives on offense. Get back to the pace they had established early in the season. They felt they had slowed down, however imperceptibly they had slowed down in the last couple, three games before the bye. And then get Demaryius Thomas the ball even more often. You look at Thomas as a special talent, don't you?
Absolutely. Derek, you know, he is a player that, you know, you can't coach the things he does. You know, in football, we used to say this, you know, a player chose their parents well. And what that means is genetically they're very gifted. You know, DT is a player that can separate from defenders. He's big enough to break tackles. He can make plays just because he's quick and fast. It's unique to have players that are quick and fast. Fast is 100 meters. Quick is, you know, 20 meters. And DT is one of those players that is athletic enough to make plays with his feet. And he's also big enough to break tackles and make big plays in the open field. So, yeah, getting DT as the ball is something that's wise. But, again, here goes, defenses know that. And so if I was defending him, I would definitely get somebody over the ball with him and get, you know, make it tough to get a free release so he doesn't, we don't give him that chance as well.
It's interesting. The Kansas City corners, Sean Smith, I believe, is 6'3". Marcus Cooper, 6'2". Flowers 5'9", but Flowers figures to match up if they're going with a nickel look, which they do a lot. He's going to be matched up against Welker. So 5'9" is no problem for Flowers matched up against Welker.
Right.
But how about Smith or Cooper at 6'3", 6'2", matched up against Demaryius and Decker?
Right.
How do you and they love man-to-man.
Yep.
And that's a pride themselves. We're not going to go with a lot of zone.
Right.
We're going man-to-man. And we're presumably going to spend a lot of time covering Demaryius Thomas with just one defender.
Yeah, and here's the deal. Don't underestimate that those two big corners covering Denver's two big receivers and Flowers, a smaller corner covering, you know, Welker, that's not just arbitrary, okay? That didn't just fall out of the sky. There's a specific purpose that they acquired big corners and people to put them in certain situations because they want to be able to defend that. That's just being an astute defensive mind. Andy Reid is very astute both on both sides of the ball.
Andy Reid's building his team to beat Denver. He doesn't care about San Diego. He doesn't care about the Raiders. He's building his team to beat Denver.
Well, essentially, yes. Essentially, I mean, he wants to beat any team he plays, but you have to beat the best.
But he knows Denver's the best.
We've known that for years, that coaches will say, we've got to beat the best. And that's what he's essentially doing when he's deploying personnel that matches up well with what Denver has.
I said Andy Reid, Bob Sutton, too, is a veteran coach, smart defensive coach.
Absolutely. So they have, yes, they have in 1 year, Sandy, I remind you, in 1 year, they have really, you know, kind of manipulated their personnel to be able to match up very well with what Denver deploys.
More ahead with Dr. Rick Perea on a Bud Light Football Friday. This is your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Buck Talk continues on a Bud Light Football Friday here on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan at 11:33. Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest. Good to have the good doctor back with us, particularly on this Friday. All right, we haven't talked about this very much during the course of the week. We did last week to a great extent in the wake of John Fox surgery. The impact that Fox might have on this game if he were here, the possible effects of his being absent, what kind of effect might that have? We haven't talked about that very much this week. You have some thoughts on it, though, Doctor.
I do. From an organizational perspective, Sandy, when you lose your visual, vocal, verbal leader, which John Fox is, and any NFL head coach really sits on a pulpit that they're up there, they're very visual in their position. They're very verbal in their position. So when you lose that leader, there will be some disruption. Now, I want to clarify for the listeners, when I say disruption, that doesn't necessarily mean negative. It could also be positive. what happens, any organization goes through different phases when they lose a leader. And one of those phases is called storming. And then the next phase is called norming. And then the last one is called performing. And so what that means is the Broncos may actually improve without Fox's presence. And I'm not necessarily saying because Del Rio's a better coach per se, but that organization now has different responsibilities. Okay, let me give you an example. We talk about cohesion with teams. There's two types of cohesion we look at in sports psychology, task and social cohesion. The task cohesion has changed. Now Del Rio's not only the defensive coordinator who's calling the plays, but he's also the head guy. So task responsibility has changed. That's going to change the cohesion. The linebacker coach, the defensive back coach, the defensive line coach now have all more input, which could disrupt the cohesion. Again, let me emphasize, it could improve it. Again, it's not to say Fox is a better or worse coach than Del Rio, but I would like us to really think about cohesion in terms of losing our leader. Oftentimes, organizations find out through situations like this, through illness, through whatever kind of attrition, that leaders within their own organization were better suited than the previous or the incumbent leader. And I'm not saying that, you know, Fox, it's good that Fox is not well. We all wish him well. But I'm saying this. The Broncos are in pretty good hands. And I'll say this.
It would seem that way.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Del Rio has that kind of experience. He has the player's ear. He's a former player. And if you look at him non-verbally, Sandy, and that's, you know,
talk about that. Yeah. Yeah. I'm fascinated here because we all comment on what they say during press conferences,
right,
and try to read between the lines. But you look at the non-verbal stuff, don't you?
Absolutely. Sandy, you know, that's one of my competencies. And I'll say this for the listeners. Non-verbal communication is 80% more reliable than verbal. Verbal, I can just look at you and lie. But nonverbal communication really communicates the truth. And when you watch Jack Del Rio on the sidelines, he conveys leadership. He conveys authority. He conveys that I'm in charge. Not that Fox does not, but Del Rio does it to an exponential level that I think the players really gravitate towards him and follow him. Remember, leaders, the leader relationship with followers, leaders have no power unless followers give them that. In other words, they have to concede for you to be an effective leader. So many times when leaders lead, followers don't follow, and that leader doesn't have power. Del Rio has power because he has that nonverbal communication that says, I'm here, I'm confident, I believe in myself, and let's go. He oozes confidence just from the nonverbal perspective.
I like the fact he's asked last week about, now that you're the head coach, how much are you going to have to do with the offense? And without hesitation, but with a smile, he says, very little.
Yeah.
But nonverbal, I mean, you can parse that any way you want. But to me, that was an expression of confidence.
Absolutely.
And leadership.
Yes.
Although it may not have seemed that way. What do you mean, leadership? Guy's saying he's going to have very little to do with the offense. But with the way he spoke it and the expression on his face when he spoke it,
yes.
That's a leader. That's a comfortable, secure leader saying that.
Absolutely. Great leaders are able to deploy responsibilities to other people that have competencies. He understands the offensive coordinator is doing well in his job. Peyton Manning.
And you have Peyton Manning.
You know, Peyton Manning is player slash coordinator himself. So he's very confident in that. And great defensive coordinators recognize great offensive coordinators, and they let them take the ball. So for him to be able to say, yeah, I'm not going to have very much to do with it, is very smart, and it really accentuates what kind of leadership skills that he does to have.
You know, the Manning ankle injury business has gotten a lot of attention this week. Will he play? Won't he play? Should he play? Shouldn't he play? What signals is he sending out? Is he hurt worse than he's letting on? Is he playing possum? Whatever. What's your reading on this whole business of Manning and the protection maybe not being as good in recent games and hobbling around at the end of the game but not coming out against San Diego last week, almost immediately after the game declaring that he'd be okay to play this week? What do you make of all that?
Well, psychologically, Sandy, I think Peyton Manning is one of the, you know, people talk about how, quote-unquote, tough Peyton Manning is, and I think really what separates Peyton Manning from the rest of the quarterbacks, because in my eyes, he's one of the top two or three quarterbacks of all time because of his mental ability to process. And I don't call it mental toughness. I know some people do. toughness conveys this attitude that you're hardened or you're, you know, you can fight off something. We want to call it mental enhancement, mental enrichment. That's really what we focus on, is being very proficient mentally. And that's what he is. So whether, I don't know if he's really hurt or how hurt he is, but the bottom line is if there's a player out there that can overcome it mentally, he's one that can. He deals so well in positive affirmations, what we call positive self-talk, which is intrapersonal communication. He does very well with that. So whether his injury is severe or not, he is the type of player that will be able to fight through that from a mental perspective.
Interesting. And I was reading an interview the other day with Tom Bahali, and he at first expressed his admiration, consummate admiration for Peyton Manning, and then went on to say, I basically pay no attention to all his gesturing at the line of scrimmage. I pay no attention to this talk about whether he's banged up or not. I ignore the whole thing. And I'm reading that, and I'm thinking, smart guy.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. Because, again, we've talked about this before, about all of the verbal gestures, the nonverbal gestures that Peyton Manning
makes.
Which
you have contended, as he does, mean
nothing.
Largely nothing.
Right. They mean largely nothing. And I think, again, look at the nonverbal is more reliable than the verbal. You know, we've done research, Sandy. Quarterbacks, 80% of quarterbacks, when they break the huddle, if they huddle, they will look in the direction that they're going to go. So for me, if I really want to know where Peyton Manning is going, I'm watching his eyes the minute that they start the play clock, because that's going to tell me more of where he's going than hurry, hurry, razor, razor, whatever he's saying back there.
303-228-1043, 295-88 on the Total Beverage text line. When we come back, you spent some time down in Alabama recently, and you had some interesting stories to bring back about not only the football program, but the athletic program in general.
Yes.
Down there. And we'll get to some of those thoughts in just a few moments. But before we break, just in capsule form, because, again, we spent a lot of time talking about this Miami Dolphins story last week. It continues to evolve this week. Give us in capsule form your reaction to all of this business, and generally the subject of bullying / hazing in National Football League locker rooms.
Yeah. You know, I have a little anecdote real quickly, Sandy. When I was in Tuscaloosa last weekend, I actually was talking with a former Alabama offensive lineman who's now playing in the NFL. But I'll keep his name, you know, between us. You know, I talked to him about this, and he says, you know, it's time that somebody came out and took a stand. And I thought that was a very interesting perspective.
Yeah, that is.
He said that, you know, there's always been a climate and a culture of, you know, guys making fun of each other and joking with each other. And he says sometimes it went, you know, racially and things like that. He says, but he thinks there needs to be a time where things are not appropriate. Because if you look at the corporate world, Sandy, there are certain things that are just not appropriate to say. But in NFL locker rooms, that doesn't necessarily, you know,
equate. It's no holds barred.
Yeah, it's no holds barred. So I think this athlete, I thought, brought an interesting perspective. They thought it was important. And again, he's presently playing in the NFL, that he said that he thought this needed to come out because there's a lot of teams that really are deploying inappropriate communication and behavior in the locker rooms.
Talk more about Dr. Perea's recent visit to Tuscaloosa when we continue on this Bud Light Football Friday. Sandy Clough, Dr. Rick Perea in studio on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Sandy Clough with you on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan, Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest. I want to read this text to you because it represents the other side of the expression you just identified coming from the Alabama player regarding the bullying hazing issue. And let's see if I can get – it's a rather lengthy text. We'll try to capture the essence of it. From the 970. Yeah, so since the corporate workplace has gone the way of the wimp, let's make the NFL the same. Seems to me we live in America where rule number one is I can say whatever I want, and no one, not another person or the government, can infringe on that right. as in free speech, as in you don't have a right to not be offended. Seriously, what happens to someone who gets offended? Do they wake up crippled the next day or something? No, nothing happens when you get offended. Get over it. We hear some of that mentality expressed in response to this sort of story. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is that the texter, I think, should become a little more sensitive to the psychological implications of certain types of communication and behavior. Yeah, you know, the NFL is definitely a league of tough guys playing a tough game. It's a violent game, and I understand that. I played it. But, you know, communication can hurt, can really, you know, infiltrate someone's belief system, especially if it's racially charged, if it's ethnically charged, or gender specific. I mean, so we've got to be very careful in our society, at regardless of what the climate and culture is. And I know football is a real machismo sport, but we've got to be careful that our communication is appropriate and it's germane to what we're doing. You know, you may say, what are you going to do? Wake up with a broken leg if somebody teases you? No. But again, that can break down your belief system. And when I was just mentioning team cohesion, a big part of team cohesion is social cohesion. And the great teams, you know, people call it chemistry, but it's not chemistry. It's called cohesion. You know, you can't really define what chemistry is, but we can define what cohesion is. And cohesion is, the social cohesion is that players get along. They respect each other. They really, literally love each other. And so that doesn't help build that cohesion when you have communication that is offensive to certain individuals. So I think we got to be really careful to understand that you can be a badass tough guy and kick somebody's butt all over the field,
yeah,
but you can also be a sensitive, caring person,
right,
to understand people's, you know, belief systems that may be different from yours.
I thought Dan Reeves put it well last week when he said, here's the acid test. Are your actions and words bringing the locker room together or tearing it apart? It seems fairly clear what happened in this instance.
Very well said by Coach Reeves, because, yeah, is it making you more cohesive or is it tearing down that social cohesive piece? And spoken from a true coach like Coach Reeves, he understands that. And I think anybody, you know, again, when you're out on the field, it's a different climate and culture. I understand that. But when you're in the locker room, we need to be very respectful of each other.
All right. We continue to the top of the hour, 303-228-1043, 295-88, Total Beverage text line. You've spent a lot of time around the Alabama football program. You're in Tuscaloosa recently, and not only looking at the football program, but a variety of athletic endeavors coming out of Alabama at this point. They've had success in other sports as well. There's kind of team psychology that not only applies to football, but all sports there that you followed and admire, I presume, to some degree. Talk about that.
Absolutely. You know, I sat down, I spent over 3 hours with Joe Panunzio, who's the director of football operations, but he also has a dual role. He's the assistant athletic director there. And, you know, their overall athletic program, Sandy, is really in tune with the mental enhancement piece. You know, all of their teams use mental enhancement coaches. Trevor Moad is their number one guy that's with him on a day-to-day basis. But they bring people like me in from time to time to speak and to help not only just football, but volleyball. You know, we watched volleyball Friday night. My wife, Melanie, played volleyball at the University of Alabama, and we watched their volleyball team, and they, you know, they have mental enhancement coaches working with them. And so, you know, they're gymnastics teams. I can't even name the number of national championships they've won. I mean, it's in the teens. So they really have a belief system that the mental piece is an important aspect. And that bleeds over into Nick Saban. You know, I would think more coaches would understand what Nick Saban is doing down there. It's truly special. I mean, you know, watching them Saturday night, Sandy, I'm telling you, when they settled in the second half and just ran power and ISO at LSU, they couldn't stop them.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, barring any injuries or barring something, you know, McCarron or something like that going down, this team is probably going to win another national championship. And so my point is, one of the reasons he's doing this is not only because of mental enhancement, because he believes and he understands that mental piece is such a vital aspect of everything we do. And if you think about it, Sandy, anybody who's out there driving in their car today, when they go to work every day, their mental attitude and how they approach their job is so vitally important to their success. And it doesn't change on the athletic field. How you approach a game, a match, a tournament, whatever it is, your mental aspect, your mental frame on that given day will largely color your experience that day. And I want people to understand so much with athletics how much the mental piece plays a role in your day-to-day success.
And a role in Alabama's success.
Absolutely.
And specifically on the football field, which is what we talk about probably more on shows like these. Getting back to the whole Miami situation, hard to believe that would happen in a Nick Saban locker room, in a Bill Belichick locker room, in a Mike Tomlin locker room, in a Tom Coughlin locker room, in a John Fox, Jack Del Rio locker room.
Yeah.
Almost impossible to visualize a situation that would develop along the same lines.
Right, you got it nailed
there,
Sandy.
I would not be stopped.
You got it nailed there, because that would not happen in a Nick Saban locker room, because he's got guys on his team that are watching out for each other.
Not a wimpy place, by the way, for the previous texter.
Not a wimpy place, right. And they're very sensitive to each other's needs. You know, there's a lot of cultural differences down there in the South, you know, and so he's got to have his hands on that program, and he does a very good job at that. So I think it's really imperative that people understand, you know, Alabama football, one of the reasons they're dominating to the level they do is because they're very cognizant and aware of the mental piece, and sometimes it comes back to that. You know, I had a chance to sit down with Greg Brown, who's, you know, from Arvada
our
High
son,
School.
Our friend.
Went to Arvada High School. He's a local guy, coached at CU, and now he's at Alabama's defensive back coach. And, you know, I can't tell you what a good, sensitive man this guy is. And I think it rains through that whole program. Football players are saying, hey, Dr. P, what's going on? And they're so respectful of each other. And, you know, when we think of a quote-unquote badass teams that win national championships, respectful, honorable football players doesn't necessarily always come to mind. But I'll tell you what, that Alabama program is doing it the right way, and more coaches should learn from the way he runs not only his during-the-season program, but his off-season program. They could learn a ton by going down there and visiting and seeing the structure and discipline he uses within his organization.
We always learn a ton whenever you're in studio with us. We're glad to have you back. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Sandy. It's always great to be here.
We'll have you back in a few short weeks. The season now starts to get interesting, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
From the Bronco point of view, two games with Kansas City, New England game sandwiched in between.
Yep.
Over the next month, it's going to be a lot of fun.
So you're not even going to ask for my prediction?
You have 15 seconds.
I'm going to, you know, I heard your other three guests.
Yeah.
I'm going to go Kansas City by 1 point. I'm going to go out on a line here.
All right. Well, that's our view of balance and all points of view getting on out there. All right. You have Kansas City by a point.
By a point.
All right.
They got to get a defensive turnover for a touchdown. If they do, they'll win by 1 point.
All right. That's it. And on that note, we can tell all that you did. Text line will explode, and you'll beat a hasty retreat.
Right.
Thanks a lot. Or Drew and Scott, I guess. They'll have to deal with all of the fallout from your prediction over the next 3 hours from noon to 3. And then, of course, the drive with Big Al and D-Mac from 3 to 6. We've enjoyed it. A Bud Light Football Friday, and we continue on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan.
You act like you don't want to listen when I'm